We're at the Royal Society in London, continuing meeting some of the participants and presenters at the discussion meeting on the new science of aging. We're with Professor Janet Lord from the University of Birmingham, who's a principal investigator in the MRC Medical Research Council Centre for Immune Regulation at Birmingham University Medical School. So you're looking at a lot of the other stuff we've been talking about today has been about theoretical positions and so on, various theories of aging and so on. I'm not saying that you're not interested in theories of aging, but you're also at the sharp end. You're dealing with people suffering and looking for possible ways to ameliorate some of the degenerative diseases of aging, like rheumatoid arthritis and so on, by principally focusing on immune responses.
That's right.
So I wonder if you could give me some sort of a bit of a gloss on that and some sense.
So we're particularly interested in what determines susceptibility to bacterial infections in older adults. And we're working on a cell called the neutrophil. And it's very much a frontline defense. So whenever you get any sort of infection, it's one of the first cells that comes in. It moves out of the blood to wherever the infection is. It might be your lungs, it might be in your legs, your heart, wherever it is. And then we'll try to deal with that infection. And it basically will phagocytose, it will eat the pathogen, kill it by generating reactive oxygen and nitrogen species, and also releasing degradative proteases onto the target. And then it will then basically actually kill itself. So it induces apoptosis in itself. So the cell itself dies and then is then removed by other cells in the body. And what we found out, we know that older people are much more susceptible to bacterial infections than younger people. And interestingly, even when they clear that infection, they can be frail afterwards, very ill. They can take weeks and weeks to recover. And so what we found out is that the neutrophil from an older person, essentially in its ability to move from the blood to wherever the site of infection is much reduced. So it's very inefficient in its movement. So it's slower to get to the infected site. Also, once it gets there, its ability to phagocytose the target, to eat the bacteria, is about 50% of that seen in a young person. So the two things combined really mean that that part of our immune system just doesn't function as well. And then there are real consequences for the older person, so they are more susceptible to infections. But then, as I said, they also don't resolve those infections as quickly as well, so they can actually be ill afterwards for much longer.
So there's a number of things that obviously happen as you age. But here's what I'm wondering. Some of the things that people have attempted to do interventions in and do replacements and replacement therapies, I'm thinking of things like hormone replacement therapy and so on. Yes, it dwindles off as you get older and so on. But some of those replacements have been possibly deleterious. I mean, some of them have been cancer-inducing in women. So what happens in the case of a system that is going where the neutrophil capacity, the immune response, is diminishing? Is there an intervention that you can do, and does the intervention itself have any potential downside?
Okay.
So Yes,
I think I understand. So what we've done along these lines, we were really very interested in, a lot of the work that we'd done was really taking neutrophils from a healthy older person. Right. So we were very interested in what happens. You know, was it really making them more susceptible to infection? Because this was what is happening in a healthy person. So what we've particularly been studying is situations in which we know the body's put under a stress. So we've looked at patients with hip fracture, because we know they're much more susceptible to infections. And we've also looked at older people under emotional stress, so bereavement. Mm. So a couple married for 40 years, one of them passes away. We know there's a higher mortality in the surviving partner. So to take me back to the first example, we found that in older people with hip fracture, and these were older people who were previously very healthy. We only looked at ones that were very healthy prior to a fall and then hip fracture. And what we found is almost 40% of those patients in the 6 weeks after the hip fracture came down with a serious infection, serious enough to require them to return to hospital. And the majority were bacterial infections. 1 in 10 of them were dead within a year, and these are previously healthy older adults. So from that, we reasoned that one of the explanations might be an altered stress response in older people. And so then we looked at stress hormones, so to come back to your first point. And what we found is when we looked at older people with a fracture compared to young people with a fracture, that the older person had a 7 times higher levels of stress hormones. So they were more stressed. And the thing about stress hormones is we know that they suppress the immune system.
So this is cortisol.
Yeah, so what we were particularly interested in, that's right, so cortisol was one of the things that we looked at. And we know that your ability to generate cortisol does not change with age, but when you have any sort of a stress, you also generate another hormone from the adrenal cortex, the same place as cortisol, called DHEA. So that's dehydroepiandrosterone. It's another steroid hormone. And you do your ability to make that hormone declines with age.
Right.
So what we looked at is the ratio of those two. Because although cortisol is a suppressor of immune function, there was some evidence at the time that DHEA was a counterbalance and was an enhancer of immune function. And sure enough, we found that those patients that had the highest cortisol to DHEA ratio, so that's the immune suppressor to the immune enhancer, they were the ones that went down with an infection and fared less well. And so we then carried on to try and get a little bit more direct proof. So we took neutrophils from older people and then incubated them with various ratios of cortisol and DHEA. And sure enough, we found that the DHEA could overcome this suppression by the cortisol. So we're now wanting to go into these older hip fracture patients and supplement them with DHEA. Yeah. You can give orally to see if we can then improve the function of neutrophils in these patients and reduce the number of infections they get.
So at the moment, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. No. You're not actually making a recommendation that DHEA should be a supplement. You're testing it to see.
Absolutely.
If it's,
yes, we don't know yet. So we're really at the trial stage now of giving this compound to older adults with hip fracture to simply see if we can improve their prognosis, improve neutrophil function.
Because I don't know if this is it's the same here, but in the States, DHEA is certainly a supplement that's in health food stores.
Yes.
And people do take it as they get older.
But you also have to be a little bit wary there because it's not regulated and it's available over the counter, of course. Then you have to be a little bit wary because we actually tested 12 sources of DHEA from the States and only 2 of them had the stated dosage. So again, they're not regulated, you see, available over the counter. So you do have to be very wary that the tablet actually contains what it's supposed to.
You mean they had less than?
Yes. Some of them barely detectable. So I think that's another warning there, really. But we won't know for a while. But I think because this hormone is often made in response to stress, that its real role is going to be in a stress reaction in the older people, I think. So it could be quite telling. But we really won't know until we've completed this study, which is going to take 2 or 3 years to complete before we've got enough patients going through to tell us if that is a positive effect.
Yeah. Now, in terms of, this is the meetings called New Science of Aging and so on. Do you have the sense that there's definitely traction going on here, much more interest in the underpinnings of it?
I think there is. I think for so many years we thought that aging was really inevitable, that aging was always going to be associated with ill health, that really there was nothing you could do about it. It was too complex to try to understand. And I think the new science of aging has really revealed that although it is complex in that it affects many systems in our body, that there may be mechanisms that are common to all of these systems and that actually we can intervene, that aging is malleable, that we can extend lifespan, certainly in model species, but more importantly, that those species that have the extended lifespan also are healthier. And I think as far as humans are concerned, that's the key aim, is really to make sure that we live a healthy older age.
Yeah. Do you have any particular, are there any camps that you belong to in terms of the various theories that are out there at this point? I mean, the oxidative stress stuff and do we have a use-by date? Is there a limit on human lifespan? Could it be increased incrementally, as people like Aubrey de Grey have suggested, so that you're living hundreds of years?
Yeah.
Do you think about all this stuff?
Yes, I do think an awful lot about this. I think at the moment we haven't got too much evidence that we can increase maximum lifespan in human beings. So I'm with the camp that, you know, if we whatever interventions we choose, that the hope is that we will increase health span more. So we'll get the average lifespan. So we'll get more people living to older age and they'll be living healthier. So I don't really go in the camp that we can extend actual maximum lifespan at the moment, or certainly not significantly. As far as mechanism, again, I think there's going to be more than one. I think this, the idea of the build-up of damage, again, the ideas are pretty strong there now. So whether it's aggregates of protein, whether it's damaged DNA, again, I think we've got quite a lot of evidence now that this build-up of damage is certainly one thing that's limiting lifespan. So I would certainly come down in that camp.
Yeah. How there's obviously a boomer generation going on, so there's obviously more people concerned about this. But I hear from a lot of scientists that there still isn't enough money, funding, going into basic research to deal with this sort of thing, so that there's a huge amount of money being expended on dealing with the diseases that result from living longer.
Yes.
But not much money being put into seeking prevention, which would obviously have a leverage its effects multiple times if in place. Is that
absolutely true? There was an analysis done, I don't know the figures for the recent, but in about around 2005, the UK funding councils did an analysis, and of the budget, of the whole budget, even spent on any sort of ageing research, so whether it's treating disease or whatever, only 2% of the budget was on prevention. The rest of it, as you said, was really treating disease. And I think, you know, if we're really going to try to ensure that people do live a healthy older life, we've really got to look at, I think, prevention from, you know, right from the start, because the costs of treating disease are just way outweigh prevention. So some people think that ageing research is expensive. It's nothing compared to disease.
No, it's just hard to get this across, though, especially if you're one of the people who's got disease. You want to say, cure me, fix me, do your research later.
Yeah, so. But again, the research shows that if you can tackle ageing, then because the ageing has the link to disease, you really treat most of, or certainly can slow down most of the pathologies we associate with ageing. So as you say, rather than trying to tackle them piecemeal, so trying to find a cure for cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, by addressing the core issue of the fact that the number one risk factor for these is aging, then by intervening there and extending health span, lifespan, you know, you're really going to make a big impact on all of those areas. As I said, rather than trying to tackle them one by one and piecemeal.
Yeah. So aging, in fact, was not thought of as being something tractable. It was just sort of this metaphysical blanket term.
Yes.
And the other things were the things that you're supposed to be treating, whereas in fact...
They all appear to be linked. Yeah. So in all of these model studies where they've extended lifespan, you know, all of the factors go down. The reduced cancer, their immune system stays in good shape, less heart disease, the skin's in good condition, hair isn't lost. You know, so you really do have a real wide range of effects by improving lifespan.
So do you actually work with hospitals as well, in hospitals or?
Yes. So where I'm based at the University of Birmingham, we're actually
medical
school there. We're very closely linked. So the Biomedical Research Institute has clinicians in it. It has basic scientists like myself. And we work very closely together. So a lot of our work is really what we call translational. So I'm interested in taking our understanding of the effect of aging on the immune system to really treating patients. So for example, in our area of rheumatoid arthritis, we've known for quite a few years now.
Because that must be a hugely common complaint.
Absolutely. Very, very common. And osteoarthritis, even more common.
Yeah.
And although we've got treatments now, we've got these anti-TNF treatments, there's still a third of patients don't respond to those treatments. And again, age is a big factor in rheumatoid arthritis. So we know that one of the things that happens with aging to your immune system is that you get a change in your response to an infection. You respond basically by producing different immune hormones. And in a study carried out at the University of Birmingham where we looked at all patients coming to their GP with any sort of synovitis, so any sort of swelling of their joints, they were brought to the University of Birmingham. We took a sample from the joints and analysed the immune reaction going on in those joints, and then followed them to see which of these patients would just resolve their inflammation and get better, and that's the majority of them, and those that went on to develop arthritis. And what we found was a cytokine profile, a hormone, this reaction, was absolutely predictive of those that would develop rheumatoid arthritis. And it was the same profile you see in an older person. So this aging of the immune system seems to predispose to rheumatoid arthritis. So again, it's given us a fundamental insight to some of the factors that might be causing people to develop rheumatoid arthritis rather than resolving their inflammation.
See, I mean, although it makes sense what you're saying, I'm not sure that, the average person would think that their immune system would the wheels would come off it, you know, as they aged. I mean,
they wouldn't do. I don't think they would think about it. Yet when you ask the average person in the street, if there's going to be a flu epidemic, who should we look out for and be aware of? They'll say the elderly straight away. So they've got it there in the back of their understanding that older people, you know, if there's an infection going around, they're most likely to get it and suffer from it. So they sort of know that, but perhaps haven't made the two connections that the reason that is because their immune system declines with aging. So any new infections that come along, they're basically not able to cope with.
Yeah. How did you get into this whole neck of the woods, this business to begin with?
Oh, it's they say, you know, it's rather like everything in science. I followed the money. So one of our research councils, the BBSRC, had a new initiative around 10 years ago now called SAGE, the Science of Aging. And they put a call out basically saying that they wanted life scientists to work on really any aspect of aging that would help us to understand the basic biology of aging and how that might influence ultimately disease. And you didn't have to have worked in aging before, and they said just come forward with a hypothesis. And so I thought, I hadn't worked in aging before, so I spent a few weeks reading around and thought, yes, actually, I think there might be something that could interest us there. I was, you know, my group worked on neutrophils, on chronic inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. And so we proposed that perhaps neutrophils didn't work efficiently in the elderly. And we put a proposal forward and it was funded, and that was it. And now the majority of my team now work on aging.
So how did you decide to go into science in the first place?
Oh, right. That's a hard one. So I think from around the age of 13, I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I think it was from watching science documentaries on television, as simple as that. I'm not from a science background. There are no other scientists in the family. I remember being captivated by programs like Horizon and really, you know, just knew I wanted to do something in science.
Oh, that's interesting. There's still an issue. I mean, I still deal with this when I'm talking to female scientists on the Science Network and ask them if they still feel like it, they're sort of having a harder row to hoe than the male scientists. In the States, at least, they still say yes, it's still tough, and so on. I don't know whether you felt there was any.
Yes, I think it is. I think it is still tough. I think you've only got to look at the number of female professors in the UK, and it tells you everything, really. So, and I think, you know, a lot of it is this work-life balance. You know, so you know, if you're going to decide to have your family, it's just around the time when most scientists would be seeking a permanent position. You know, so the timings often don't fit. You're having to, you know, give a bit more time to childcare, and you're just at that critical stage in your career where you're trying to set up your own team. So that can be difficult. So I think a lot of females drop out of the system there. And I think it's compounded by a lack of role models as well. So again, I know in my own personal development, in my own department, there were no female professors. In fact, I don't think there were any even female members of staff. So I was fortunate enough to be mentored by somebody who really did encourage me. So I think the mentor role and the role models are really important. So I think if we can get more women in senior positions in science, I think that might, you know, encourage other females to stay on beyond in their senior postdoc years rather than to perhaps leave and go to industry or some other line of science.
Yeah, and well, actually, these rooms that we're in are the President's apartment at the Royal Society, and they're having a celebration tomorrow for the centennial of Dorothy Hodgkin. So there's a good, great female scientist being celebrated. Yeah. Did you ever think of doing anything else? Was the idea was to go into science?
It was always science, yes. I never thought of anything else. And even though most of my work is very clinically related, I never even thought of doing medicine. It was basic science, and from a very, very early age.
Yeah. Give me some sense of how you feel about the way in which science is viewed. I'm thinking about the States and here. This is the 350th anniversary of the Royal Society this year, so longest running uninterrupted science business on the planet, as a society anyway. And obviously it seems to me that there's a certain respect for it, the British Association and so on, lots of promotion of science going on, the Cheltenham Science Festival and so on. In the States, the President Obama, when he took office in his inaugural address, said he would, his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Didn't say exactly what that was. So what do you think is the rightful place of science?
I think it should be preeminent, and particularly in the crisis, we've got the fiscal crisis at the moment. I think if we're really going to get out of it, several of the politicians have certainly said it in the UK, that innovation is the way forward. You know, you look at the President Obama's response to the crisis was to give a huge fiscal stimulus to science, but it hasn't happened here in the UK. And if anything, you know, we're expecting cuts. There have already been cuts to the science budget. And when the government is decided and comes in, you know, we're expecting potentially further cuts as well. So I think there's a disengagement there, really, certainly in the UK. So that I think there is the respect, and you talk to parliamentarians, you talk to people in the public, I think they do see the importance of science, but there's the disconnect there in actually funding it. It's seen as expensive, it's a bit of a gamble, so you can't always predict which ones are going to pay off. And you certainly can't, you know, you really just got to put a faith a lot of the time in it. But, you know, I think there is this disconnect. I think it is valued in a lot of ways, and we can see that we can get new drugs, we can get inventions that ease life, that allow us to move forward, and we'll develop our economy. But there seems this almost unwillingness to actually invest in the first place in it.
When we came into the country, did what I usually do, go and pick up some magazines, look around and so on. And there were several articles that were critical of changes that are going on. I'm talking about Britain now in terms of the universities. Departments being cut. More translational things being funded rather than just basic research.
That's right.
Yes, and again, I think that's the worry. I think the certain absolute push at the moment on translational research, which is fine. Yeah. If we are going to get a lot of our discoveries, as we say, from the bench to the bedside, you do need to support that.
Right.
But you also can't cut basic science, because then you lose your pipeline. So I think, again, you know, we do need to invent it in the translational area, but you can't cut the basic science either, because that's where the ideas of the future are going to come from. So you've really got to fund both. And I think people can connect easily with the translational side. They can see that if you're working on a new drug for diabetes or cancer, yes, they can see that, but they perhaps can't see that we're understanding, you know, the basic biology of these drugs, or the basic biology of aging. How would that help us? Yeah. And I think that's where perhaps the politicians and the general public wouldn't naturally be aware. But it's interesting, the Research Council's carried out an exercise with Ipsos Mori, looking at attitudes to aging research. And when they began by explaining what ageing research has done and can do, then people increased their support for it, agreed that yes, it was a good idea, but before they'd heard the evidence of what ageing research could do, generally they gave it a very low ranking as a priority. So it's interesting, I think a lot of it is just that people really don't understand what the research could do half of the time. So some of it's very obvious, they can see there's a new drug coming. But perhaps in the case of ageing research, it wouldn't be obvious to people that it would be beneficial to understand why we age.
Yeah, the session you're about to chair shortly, Future Directions for the New Science of Ageing. Mm. I mean, what do you think of the future directions?
Precisely. So I think, you know, we need to, we're at a place now where I think we've accepted certain positions, such as the fact that ageing is malleable. That if we understand and can extend lifespan, that we can also improve health in old age. So I think we're all pretty together on that. I think where we are now is deciding, well, which of the processes that we understand contribute to the negative aspects of ageing, which of those could we intervene in? now and which are perhaps a few stages away. So I think there's going to be a discussion certainly around the table now saying, look, could we act now? You know, could we intervene now and make some big changes? And what do we need to perhaps improve if we're going to get some of the drugs that are really only there in animal models at the moment, perhaps into humans as well? And I think there's also going to be a deep discussion around, or I'm certainly going to bring it up, around some of the epidemiological evidence that says that four simple lifestyle behaviours, so this came out of Katie Kaur's work on a cohort called the EPIC Norfolk cohort, and they've discovered that by stopping smoking, keeping a healthy weight, keeping physically active and eating four pieces of fruit or vegetable a day, those combined will give you an extended lifespan of 14 years. So if we do that, if we can change those health behaviours in most of the population, can we extend anything further? Or are the treatments we're doing now in these model organisms simply correcting some of our bad behaviours? So if a lot more of us are obese, we're physically inactive, we smoke, we perhaps take a little too much alcohol, that was another thing that came out of Katie's study, are we then simply going to use these pill approaches, that, you know, the drug interventions to reduce what we could do by simply changing our behaviours? And I think that's a discussion we're going to need to have, I think.
So, I presume that you would encourage younger scientists to go into the science of ageing, but what would your advice? One of the things that I often ask people is you know, this book by Peter Medawar, Advice to a Young Scientist. Any tips?
Oof, difficult one. So I would certainly encourage, young people to go into it. I think my tip really is to follow what interests you. I think, and not necessarily what is the flavour of the day. I know one of my mentor, I think, used to, in the early days, tear his hair out with me. He used to say, Janet, when are you going to focus on something? And I said, but what... You know, science for me is being able to follow various angles and then being able to perhaps link them together later. So I've had interests as well as in aging. So I've had my interest in basically in immunology. I've been interested in a basic biological process called cell death. And in the end, a lot of these have ended up coming together to be able to understand aging. So my tip would be to not necessarily to shoehorn yourself as into one area, but to really look at a lot of areas around you and to take interest in different aspects of science. Don't gain tunnel vision, because I think you'll really restrict the view you have and the ideas that you might have in the future.
And we're sitting in an extremely historical context here. One question I do like to ask people is, if I gave you a token that gave you unlimited time travel. Oh. Anybody you'd like to go and have dinner with and have a conversation with that you'd like to ask them some questions
that's
about?
That's a very interesting question. I guess Dorothy Hodgkin, actually. You've mentioned her already, but she would be high on my list of people that I would want to speak to really get her views about, you know, a lot of the female scientists we may complain about the situation now, but the situation she was in as a female scientist was very different there, and I think much harder. And so it would be very interesting to speak to her about, you know, her entrance into science and how she coped with a science career. She would be fascinating to meet.
I think. Well, maybe you can come in here tomorrow and channel her, but we'll see what happens. One last thing. What are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about? I'm optimistic that we can actually have a healthy older age. And I really believe that my motto is that old age can be enjoyed rather than endured. And I think that's where we should aim.
Janet Lord, thanks very much.
Thank you.